Palazzola, reel two. Right, Flip, you were telling me about your base, weren't you?
Yes. We had the Quonset huts where we lived, and it was an austere base. There wasn't anything particularly interesting around there. We weren't near, very near any towns, so we was kind of out in the fields in England. There were a couple of small villages that we became familiar with later that I enjoyed going to. But the base itself was a typical Air Force base. You had all of the activities going on with the fighter aircraft with us on.
What were they doing at the... This would have been in 1943,
yes.
Beginning of 1944, presumably. Yes, what was the main activity of the fighters at that time?
The fighters at that time, their job was to protect the bombers. Basically, that's what their jobs were. And they would go on strafing missions occasionally to try to destroy aircraft locations, I mean anti-aircraft locations. They would shoot up any planes that they would find. They weren't ours. And generally, they were a protection group, basically trying to protect the bombers, because the bombers were the ones that were doing the major damage. We used to have some of the damaged bombers that would come in and land at our base. And they would come in with parts of their wings shot off, their tail shot up. Some of them didn't have landing gear that would work. They would have to come in and belly flop and slide along, you know. And then we had fire protection people there at the base, and they would certainly get everyone out. But that was not nice to see, because you knew there were people in there, and you didn't know if they were going to make it or not. We also had hot shots at our base on the fighter pilots. They were the hot shots of the Air Force. And I can remember one time there were two P-51s that came and they buzzed the base. In other words, they came down within probably 50 feet and they were going very fast, full throttle. And at the end of the runway, they turned and went up to make a loop. And then they were going to come back. They would lose speed as they were doing this, and they were going to come back and land, and one of them didn't come out of this loop and crashed directly into the ground. So, we didn't, you know, those are the sort of things that happen. We were bombed several times by the Germans. We had our own little dugout areas that we would get into that would be protection, air raid shelters that would be protected from. There wasn't too much of that, though, and it was always at night. We never did have anything during the day.
What was your job? What were you actually doing on this base?
We were taking the radio equipment, the communications equipment, and the radar equipment, and we were repairing them. I was in charge of a group of men that were doing the repair work on these. We didn't have a whole lot to do, really. There wasn't a lot of problems, a lot of failures with the equipment. If it came back shot up, we would look at it, and if it wasn't repairable, we would scrap it, and we would use some of the parts to repair other equipment. But it was almost like having a job, 8 hours a day. You know, it just was not a big deal. As a result, I had a lot of free time, and I would go into some of the small towns around where we were, and I would pick up electronic equipment, tubes that we didn't use in our equipment, but that the English used, and the resistors and capacitors and that sort of thing. And I started building my own amplifier. And this amplifier I had in our Quonset hut, because I had this equipment, I got a corner, which gave me a whole wall all to myself, and I put my equipment in there, and I scrounged some speakers that I had bought in these little electronics places. And so I had my own little phonograph system, and I would go in and I would buy a lot of the English records. And we would play, you know, we could play these English records. I remember one of them that sounded, that I really enjoyed, was Geraldo. Yeah, he was very, we really liked his kind of music. And as I remember, Ted Heath had some, he was just beginning at that time, but he had some good records out. And we had a lot of what was her name, Lynn?
Vera Lynn?
Vera Lynn, yeah. Vera
was she popular with Americans?
Oh, yes. Yes, I think so. Yeah. And then we also used to get V-discs from America that were, we had to have special equipment though to play those on. And I got some of that equipment because I was doing that with the Red Cross, putting that in their center where they would have donuts and recreation areas, places for us to play cards and that sort of thing. And so they had V-discs. And but then I would get them also. And so we had the music. They were different.
Yes, what was a V-disc?
The V-disc was a 16-inch around instead of 12-inch, as we see now. Actually, most of our records at that time were 10-inch. And these were, no, I'm sorry, they weren't 16, they were 12-inch. They were 12-inch. But then instead of being recorded at 78 RPM, they were recorded at 16 and two-thirds RPM, which gave us a lot of music on one of these discs. It was the beginning of the long play. I know that Columbia Records claimed that they did the that they made the high fidelity long playing disc. And yes, their quality was a little better, but we had them during the war before Columbia developed them. We didn't, I mean, I'm not saying that our group did that, but those records were available at that time. And they would do all of the popular American artists. And you could get jazz, you could get dance bands, they had all different types of these discs that they would send over to us on these read discs.
Was music very important in the war?
Music's always been important to me. I've always enjoyed music very much. I don't know how important it was to everyone else, but there was, whenever we would have a group come over from the United States, we always had very good turnouts that people would want to see them and hear them. And it was a combination of the music and the personalities, I'm sure.
Yes, I was going to ask you about social life. You know, you've got your phonograph system fixed up, and it's interesting you saying you could buy all the spares, or a lot of them, from British shops.
Yeah.
Yes, so the resources were there, were they?
Yeah.
Rather than from your base.
Yeah, because we were using different kinds of equipment. Our tubes and everything would not work for any of this audio equipment that I was working with. They were completely different. And couldn't be used interchangeably. Now, some of the parts could be, but most of them were very specialized in the equipment that we had. Well, I want to mention something on this this IFF equipment that was, I think, very interesting. We knew that the Germans were capturing some of these, so we wired them with all red wires. Every connection in there had one red wire going to another. And we had a lot of red wires that went nowhere. They would wind around through here and up and down and through it because we were trying to confuse the Germans. They were trying to figure out what that wire was coming through. Just a little sidelight. Well, we were talking about the people coming over from the States to entertain us.
Yes.
That's when I started becoming involved. With them, at that time it was called Special Services Divisions, and I started setting up some of the equipment for some of the small groups that came in, and I would also go around with our own bass band that I became very friendly with, because they liked jazz and I liked jazz, so you know we had a common thing there that we both enjoy, And we would go around with this little group, and we would play for officers' dances and that sort of thing. I remember one time we went to a home. I don't suppose I should call it an old folks home, but there were old people there, mostly women. And we went up there several times, and we played music for them, and just enjoyed them so much. And they enjoyed the music, and they enjoyed seeing us. I mean, it was like just little evenings together that were just so enjoyable. And I remember them so much. Looking at you reminds me right now of some of the women. I'm not calling you old, but you look like some of the women that were there. They were so nice. And I found the English very nice. I had no problems with any English people when I was there.
But were you given advice about, you know, how to relate to the English people before you came?
I don't remember that happening, but I'm sure there were some things that they...
Did you know about rationing?
Yeah, they're different. Their idea, you know, your the English ideas and descriptions of different things were different than ours.
Did you know? Yes. Did you know about the rationing system in England?
Oh yes, because we have the rationing in the United States also. Yeah. So yes. And a little sideline of that, quite often we had things available that were not available to the English. And I can remember one time my mother sent me a package of popcorn, of kernels. And I went to this home that was in a small town. I became friendly with the family. And I remember I was able to purloin a pound of butter from the mess hall. And I went up to their home with this popcorn, and they had no idea what popcorn was. I don't know that there was any in England at that time. And so they wanted to know what we did with it. So I said, well, if you got an iron skillet, I said, well, put these kernels in that iron skillet. And I was a sneaky person, I guess. I told them, don't put a lid on it. And they started popping all over the place, you know. And we started laughing. Then I told them what we would do. We would put the lid on it, and we would pop this corn, and we'd use the butter then on it, butter and salt. So we had our popcorn. They enjoyed that, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. Did you get to know many English families?
No, there were just a few that I used to go see. While I was there, I bought a bicycle when I was in England. And I used to just go out, and instead of going into Ipswich or down to London, a lot of times I'd just go out on my bicycle to these little villages and meet people. And I enjoyed that so much. Yeah. I'm not saying I didn't go into Ipswich or Colchester or London, you know, because I did. I go down there quite often. But London was so full of GIs, it was like you're not getting away from anything. You know, you're just seeing the same kind of people all the time. It wasn't like being in England. I guess I enjoyed visiting with the people more. Mm-hmm. When I would get my leaves, and you'd get a 7-day leave, quite often the thing was so interesting, when you got a leave, you could go on the trains, and they didn't charge for any travel, so you could travel anywhere. So a couple of times I went up to Edinburgh and enjoyed that so much. Several of us would go, and we would try to go along, and I can't remember the name of the street, but there were about 100 pubs on this street right below the castle, and we were going to try to hit each one of them every night. Obviously, we never did do it. I met a very nice young lady there, and we became friends. We would write back and forth. Her name was Jasmine. I don't remember her last name now, but we used to enjoy each other a lot. And I was a very naive young man, and we had no sexual activities. It was just enjoyable, just being enjoyable with each other. The other thing that I became involved with was developing another system. This was with MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And one of the problems that we were having with the Air Force was that the fighters could not accompany the bombers. The fighters couldn't accompany them all the way in to Germany. For example, if the bombers were going to be bombing Berlin, the fighters couldn't go that far. Their gas supplies wouldn't let them go that far. I mean, they had wing tanks and everything. And one of the reasons was that the way the Germans would attack the bombers with their aircraft is they would fly very close to the ground and then come up into the formations. Well, our fighters, in order to see this kind of activity, had to fly left and right, underneath the bombers, you know, scanning constantly for any activity on the ground. And when the Germans would come up through them, then they would have their dogfights. Well, this going back and forth with their aircraft like this used up a tremendous amount of gasoline, because they were in effect flying faster than the bombers. They were using more gas than the bombers were doing this thing. And so with MIT, we developed a tail warning system. And this was a little, it was like a little radar system, a little tiny little radar system built into the aircraft. And we had three small antenna that we put on the rudder on the back of the fighters. And then we had three different positions, or two different positions. You had a 60 degree and a 90 degree. There was like a cone that was developed behind the aircraft and down, so that anything coming into that would signal a light, big red light on the dashboard. And they would know then that there was something behind them, and then they could investigate that. Well, as a result of that, the fighters were able to throttle back now and stay with the bombers, and they were able to go all the way into Berlin and back. So it gave the bombers a lot of added protection. It was so interesting with these antennas on the back on the tail. They'd give us an aircraft, and we had to figure out where to put these things. We're crawling around inside these little fighters trying to figure out. And the antennas themselves were very small. They were only about 2.5 inches long, and there were three of them, so it was like, so that's how we got our directivity. But there were three very small little antennas on the back. The IFF antennas, when we first went over there, the P-47s didn't have them. In fact, when the P-47s came, the English thought they were bombers. They were such big, heavy, and they were supposed to be fighters. These were big, heavy planes, you know. But they didn't have this IFF in them. And one of our jobs was to try to run the cabling for these, the coaxial cable, through the aircraft without destroying the actions of the aircraft. And the antennas that we used on that, oddly enough, because of the frequencies that we were using, were only 3/4 of an inch long. And we had the cable, which was 1/2 inch around, and we had to connect that on these little tiny antennas and run it through the wings. We had them out on the wing tips. We were trying all different places on the aircraft that would be the best. That was kind of fun. It's kind of interesting to do that.
It's again a lot of innovation, yes, by the, you know, the sound of it, and how satisfying that that works, so that the fighters could go all the way. Were you having any interaction with the RAF?
Not at our base, no. But I did have an interaction with them. And this is a story I guess I shouldn't be extremely proud of, but I think it was a necessary part of the war. Because of the electronic background that I had, I was put on detached service to the RAF. And I was sent up to, I believe it was, I can't remember the town now, it was an English, it was an RAF base in Scotland. And I was teaching basic electronic theories to young Englishmen that were just coming in to the RAF. And the thing that I'm not real proud of was that on D-Day, I was up in an old aircraft that had three wings on it. I don't know what model it was, but it was an old aircraft. And there were about nine of us in there. The RAF students were in there. And they were sitting at their desks in this aircraft. And this all happened on D-Day. We were up there on D-Day. We didn't realize what was happening in the rest of the country, you know, the rest of the world. So I was away from all of that at that time. And it was so interesting when I came back, all of our aircraft had the stripes, the white stripes painted on them, on the wings and around the fuselage, so that they were easily identified by our people. They did that all overnight. They printed all those aircraft.
So the aircraft on your base had actually been over to Normandy, had they?
Yes. Yeah, they were. I don't know if I remember the weather was so bad. I wasn't there, but just that the weather was bad, that they could not give the support that they really wanted to. None of the fighters could. And of course the bombers, it was, I don't think any of the bombers, very few of the bombers went on D-Day. The fighters were trying to give support, but they couldn't see anything. You couldn't see anything because the weather was so bad. Yeah.
Did things alter much after D-Day? You know, when the weather cleared for your base, did it make an impact on your sort of life and service on the base?
No, they would... they would send back any defective equipment to us from France after they landed, you know, any of the aircraft that got over there. As I remember, it was some time before the aircraft actually started landing in France and supporting our troops. So all the support was still from England. The bombers and the pilots were all still from England.
Did you have many bases, many losses on your base, Flip? You know, did you lose pilots and...
I don't recollect a lot of that because we weren't that close to the fight. I mean, we were on the same base, but they were in a different area than we were.
The pilots would have been.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I never got to know any of the pilots. Not very friendly with them. Oh, another, this has nothing to do with that subject, but something that was kind of funny happened. One of the commanding officer of our base, with his headquarters building, he wanted to put up some loudspeakers so that he could direct from his office. You know, he could use it like a public address system. And so we requisitioned these large speakers, the Tannoy speakers, and that we got from England, and we had some electronic equipment from the United States, some amplifiers and microphones and that sort of thing. And I remember I was up there with two other GIs, and we were trying to mount these speakers up on this headquarters building, And one of the junior officers comes out and just rakes us over the coals, up and down, back and forth, because we were running across the roof and it was bothering him. And he says, whose authority is this? And we told him, commanding officer. So I'm going, oh, okay.
It was all right then.
Just a little side thing, some of the little incidents that happened.
Would you have been in Britain during the time of the buzz bombs, the V1s and V2s?
We were directly under most of them, yes. Mm. Being in that part of England, which is the northeast of London and Ipswich, being in that area, that's where the buzz bombs were coming from Holland, from the Netherlands. And so they came over us, yes. And as long as we heard them, it really didn't bother us. When they were going and they suddenly stopped, we'd all take cover, because that meant that they were going to dive down and bomb. We had a few, there weren't a whole lot. Some of our crazy pilots would go up when the buzz bombs were approaching, and they would fly along. The P-51 pilots were the only ones that did this, as I remember. They would fly alongside the buzz bomb, and with their wingtip, tip the wing on the buzz bomb up, so it would then dive. And so in the countryside is where a lot of them were exploding. There was an ingenious device in the buzz bomb for controlling where they were going to go. They had a small propeller up at the front. And this, through a series of gears, reduction gears, so there's so many turns of that, it would take, I don't know what the relationship was, but so many turns of that would turn another gear and another gear and another gear. Well, the Germans could figure how many revolutions at the speed this thing was going at, with the wind turning this little propeller, how far it would go, and when it would get to the point that they felt it wanted. They were trying to bomb London, of course. That was their primary targets. So they knew the distance, and they figured the amount of time it would take for this. And this, when a propeller would get to this point, and these gears would get to this point, a solenoid would come and cut the fuel line. And that's how they turned off the engines. They cut the fuel lines, and it would dive then, because it had no more power. It was just an ingenious, simple little device that they used.
When did you know that, about the device? Were you able to find this out during the war?
Or yes, during the war. Yeah, there's no defense you can have against it. Yeah, there's nothing you can do to stop it. You didn't want to really shoot it down up in the air, because that could blow you out of the air, too. They were very noisy. I mean, you could hear them 15 miles away, and very noisy.
And there was a difference, was there not, between the V1s and V2s?
Yes. Now, the V2s you never heard. They were faster than the speed of sound. And I remember I was on leave in London, and there was a USO area, like a hotel, that we could stay in. And it was right near Marble Arch. And this one time when I was there, one of the V2s hit right near Marble Arch and knocked me out of bed. It didn't hurt me, but they were going it so fast that they did not do horizontal damage. They did vertical damage. In other words, they would dig in so far and there'd be a big crater, but they didn't do a lot of damage around. It was more psychological. I think that rather than the real damage that they were doing, there was no way they could aim them. But yes, I know. They used to say, if you hear them, you're okay. Because they would explode before you could hear them. Yes.